and finally, that Lane's text cancel the human content of its subject matter in favor of its scientific validity. It is for all these ends that the book is organized, not simply as the narrative of Lane's residence in Egypt, but as narrative structure overwhelmed by Orientalist restructuring and detail. This, I think, is the central achievement of Lane's work. In outline and shape, Modern Egyptians follows the routine of an 18th century novel, say one by Fielding. The book opens with an account of country and setting, followed by chapters on personal characteristics and infancy and early education. 25 chapters on such things as festivals, laws, character, industry, magic, and domestic life precede the last section, death and funeral rites. On the face of it, Lane's argument is chronological and developmental. He writes about himself as the observer of scenes that follow the major divisions in the human lifetime. His model is the narrative pattern, as it is in Tom Jones, with the hero's birth, adventures, marriage, and implied death. Only in Lane's text, the narrative voice is ageless. His subject, however, the modern Egyptian, goes through the individual life cycle. This reversal, by which a solitary individual endows himself with timeless faculties and imposes on a society and people a personal lifespan, is but the first of several operations regulating what might have been the mere narration of travels in foreign parts, turning an artless text into an encyclopedia of exotic display and a playground for Orientalist scrutiny. Lane's control of his material is not only established through his dramatized double presence as fake Muslim and genuine Westerner, and his manipulation of narrative voice and subject, but also through his use of detail. Each major section in each chapter is invariably introduced with some unsurprising general observation. For example, it is generally observed that many of the most remarkable peculiarities in the manners, customs, and character of a nation are attributable to the physical peculiarities of the country. What follows confirms this easily. The Nile, Egypt's remarkably salubrious climate, the peasants' precise labor. Yet, instead of this leading to the next episode in narrative order, the detail is added too, and consequently the narrative fulfillment expected on purely formal grounds is not given. In other words, although the gross outlines of Lane's text conform to the narrative and causal sequence of birth, life, death, the special detail introduced during the sequence itself foils narrative movement. From a general observation, to a delineation of some aspect of Egyptian character, to an account of Egyptian childhood, adolescence, maturity, and senescence, Lane is always there with great detail to prevent smooth transitions. Shortly after we hear about Egypt's salubrious climate, for instance, we are informed that few Egyptians live beyond a few years because of fatal illness, the absence of medical aid, and oppressive summer weather. Thereafter, we are told that the heat excites the Egyptian, an unqualified generalization, to intemperance in sensual enjoyments, and soon are bogged down in descriptions, complete with charts and line drawings of Cairene architecture, decoration, fountains, and locks. When a narrative strain re-emerges, it is clearly only as a formality. What prevents narrative order, at the very same time that narrative order is the dominating fiction of Lane's text, is sheer, overpowering, monumental description. Lane's objective is to make Egypt and the Egyptians totally visible, to keep nothing hidden from his reader, to deliver the Egyptians without depth, in swollen detail. As rapporteur, his propensity is for sadomasochistic colossal tidbits. The self-mutilation of dervishes, the cruelty of judges, the blending of religion with licentiousness among Muslims, the excess of libidinous passions, and so on. Yet no matter how odd and perverse the event, and how lost we become in its dizzying detail, Lane is ubiquitous, his job being to reassemble the pieces and enable us to move on, albeit jerkily. To a certain extent, he does this by just being a European who can discursively control the passions and excitements to which the Muslims are unhappily subject. But to an even greater extent, Lane's capacity to rein in his profuse subject matter with an unyielding bridle of discipline and detachment depends on his cold distance from Egyptian life and Egyptian productivity. The main symbolic moment occurs at the beginning of Chapter 6. Domestic life continued. By now, Lane has adopted the narrative convention of taking a walk through Egyptian life, and having reached the end of his tour of the public rooms and habits of an Egyptian household, the social and spatial worlds are mixed together by him, he begins to discuss the intimate side of home life. Immediately, he must give some account of marriage and the marriage ceremonies. As usual, the account begins with a general observation. To abstain from marriage, when a man has attained a sufficient age, and when there is no just impediment, is esteemed by the Egyptians improper and even disreputable. Without transition, this observation is applied by Lane to himself, and he is found guilty. For one long paragraph, he then recounts the pressures placed on him to get married, which he unflinchingly refuses. Finally, after a native friend even offers to arrange a mariage de convenance, also refused by Lane, the whole sequence is abruptly terminated with a period and a dash. He resumes his general discussion with another general observation. Not only do we have here a typical Lane-esque interruption of the main narrative with untidy detail, we have also a firm and literal disengagement of the author from the productive processes of Oriental society. The mini-narrative of his refusal to join the society he describes concludes with a dramatic hiatus. His story cannot continue, he seems to be saying, so long as he does not enter the intimacy of domestic life, and so he drops from sight as a candidate for it. He literally abolishes himself as a human subject by refusing to marry into human society. Thus, he preserves his authoritative identity as a mock participant and bolsters the objectivity of his narrative. If we already knew that Lane was a non-Muslim, we now know, too, that in order for him to become an Orientalist, instead of an Oriental, he had to deny himself the sensual enjoyments of domestic life. Moreover, he had also to avoid dating himself by entering the human life cycle. Only in this negative way could he retain his timeless authority as observer. Lane's choice was between living without inconvenience and discomfort and accomplishing his study of the modern Egyptians. The result of his choice is plainly to have made possible his definition of the Egyptians, since had he become one of them, his perspective would no longer have been antiseptically and asexually lexicographical. In two important and urgent ways, therefore, Lane gains scholarly credibility and legitimacy. First, by interfering with the ordinary narrative course of human life. This is the function of his colossal detail, in which the observing intelligence of a foreigner can introduce and then piece together massive information. The Egyptians are disemboweled for exposition, so to speak, then put together admonishingly by Lane. Second, by disengaging from the generation of Egyptian Oriental life. This is the function of his subduing his animal appetite in the interest of disseminating information, not in and for Egypt, but in and for European learning at large. To have achieved both the imposition of a scholarly will upon an untidy reality and an intentional shift away from the place of his residence to the scene of his scholarly reputation is the source of his great fame in the annals of Orientalism. Useful knowledge such as his could only have been obtained, formulated, and diffused by such denials. Lane's two other major works, his never-completed Arabic lexicon and his uninspired translation of the Arabian Nights, consolidated the system of knowledge inaugurated by modern Egyptians. In both of his later works, his individuality has disappeared entirely as a creative presence, as, of course, has the very idea of a narrative work. Lane the Man appears only in the official persona of annotator and retranslator, the Knights, and impersonal lexicographer. From being an author contemporary with his subject matter, Lane became, as Orientalist scholar of classical Arabic and classical Islam, its survivor. But it is the form of that survival which is of interest. For Lane's legacy as a scholar mattered not to the Orient, of course, but to the institutions and agencies of his European society, and these were either academic, the official Orientalist societies, institutions, and agencies, or they were extra-academic in very particular ways, figuring in the work of later Europeans resident in the Orient. If we read Lane's Modern Egyptians, not as a source of Oriental lore, but as a work directed towards the growing organization of academic Orientalism, we will find it illuminating. The subordination of genetic ego to scholarly authority in Lane corresponds exactly to the increased specialization and institutionalization of knowledge about the Orient represented by the various Oriental societies. The Royal Asiatic Society was founded a decade before Lane's book appeared, but its committee of correspondence, whose objects were to receive intelligence and inquiries relating to the arts, sciences, literature, history, and antiquities of the Orient, was the structural recipient of Lane's fund of information, processed and formulated as it was. As for the diffusion of such work as Lane's, there were not only the various societies of useful knowledge, but also, in an age when the original Orientalist program of aiding commerce and trade with the Orient had become exhausted, the specialized learned societies whose products were works displaying the potential, if not actual, values of disinterested scholarship. Thus, a program of the Société Asiatique states, to compose or to print grammars, dictionaries, and other elementary books recognized as useful or indispensable for the study of those languages taught by appointed professors of Oriental languages. By subscriptions, or by other means to contribute to the publication of the same kind of work undertaken in France or abroad. To acquire manuscripts, or to copy either completely or in part those that are to be found in Europe, to translate or to make extracts from them, to multiply their number by reproducing them either by engraving or by lithography. To make it possible for the authors of useful works on geography, history, the arts and the sciences to acquire the means for the public to enjoy the fruits of their nocturnal labors, to draw the attention of the public by means of a periodic collection devoted to Asiatic literature, to the scientific, literary, or poetic productions of the Orient and those of the same sort that regularly are produced in Europe, to those facts about the Orient that could be relevant to Europe, to those discoveries and works of all kinds of which the Oriental peoples could become the subject. These are the objectives proposed for and by the Société Asiatique. Orientalism organized itself systematically as the acquisition of Oriental material and its regulated dissemination as a form of specialized knowledge. One copied and printed works of grammar, one acquired original texts, one multiplied their number and diffused them widely, even dispensed knowledge in periodic form. It was into and for this system that Lane wrote his work and sacrificed his ego. The mode in which his work persisted in the archives of Orientalism was provided for also. There was to be a museum, Sassi said. A vast depot of objects of all kinds, of drawings, of original books, maps, accounts of voyages, all offered to those who wish to give themselves to the study of the Orient, in such a way that each of these students would be able to feel himself transported, as if by enchantment, into the midst of, say, a Mongolian tribe, or of the Chinese race, whichever he might have made the object of his studies. It is possible to say that after the publication of elementary books on the Oriental languages, nothing is more important than to lay the cornerstone of this museum, which I consider a living commentary upon and interpretation, Truchement, of the dictionaries. Truchement derives nicely from the Arabic turjaman, meaning interpreter, intermediary, or spokesman. On the one hand, Orientalism acquired the Orient as literally and as widely as possible. On the other, it domesticated this knowledge to the West, filtering it through regulatory codes, classifications, specimen cases, periodical reviews, dictionaries, grammars, commentaries, editions, translations, all of which together formed a simulacrum of the Orient and reproduced it materially in the West for the West. The Orient, in short, would be converted from the personal, sometimes garbled testimony of intrepid voyagers and residents into impersonal definition by a whole array of scientific workers. It would be converted from the consecutive experience of individual research into a sort of imaginary museum without walls, where everything gathered from the huge distances and varieties of Oriental culture became categorically Oriental. It would be reconverted, restructured from the bundle of fragments brought back piecemeal by explorers, expeditions, commissions, armies, and merchants into lexicographical, bibliographical, departmentalized, and textualized Orientalist sense. By the middle of the 19th century, the Orient had become, as Disraeli said, a career, one in which one could remake and restore not only the Orient, but also oneself. 4. Pilgrims and Pilgrimages, British and French. Every European traveler or resident in the Orient has had to protect himself from its unsettling influences. Someone like Lane ultimately rescheduled and resituated the Orient when he came to write about it. The eccentricities of Oriental life, with its odd calendars, its exotic spatial configurations, its hopelessly strange languages, its seemingly perverse morality, were reduced considerably when they appeared as a series of detailed items presented in a normative European prose style. It is correct to say that in Orientalizing the Orient, Lane not only defined but edited it. He excised from it what, in addition to his own human sympathies, might have ruffled the European sensibility. In most cases, the Orient seemed to have offended sexual propriety. Everything about the Orient, or at least Lane's Orient in Egypt, exuded dangerous sex, threatened hygiene and domestic seemliness with an excessive freedom of intercourse, as Lane put it more irrepressibly than usual. But there were other sorts of threats than sex. All of them wore away the European discreetness and rationality of time, space, and personal identity. In the Orient, one suddenly confronted unimaginable antiquity, inhuman beauty, boundless distance. These could be put to use more innocently, as it were, if they were thought and written about, not directly experienced. In Byron's Gaour, in the Westöstliche Divan, in Hugo's Oriental, the Orient is a form of release, a place of original opportunity, whose keynote was struck in Goethe's Hegira. Nord und West, Süd zersplitten, Throne bersten, Reiche zittern, Flüchte du in reinen Osten, Patriarchen Luft zu kosten. North, West, and South disintegrate, Thrones burst, empires tremble. Fly away, and in the pure east, taste the patriarch's air. One always returned to the Orient. Dort, im reinen und in rechten, will ich menschlichen Geschlechten, in des Ursprungs tiefe dringen. There in purity and righteousness will I go back to the profound origins of the human race, seeing it as completion and confirmation of everything one had imagined. Gottes ist der Orient, Gottes ist der Okzident, Nord und südliches Gelände ruht im Frieden seiner Hände. God is the Orient, God is the Occident. Northern and southern lands repose in the peace of his hands. The Orient, with its poetry, its atmosphere, its possibilities, was represented by poets like Hafiz. Unbegrenzt, boundless, Goethe said, older and younger than we Europeans. And for Hugo, in Cri de guerre du Mufti and La douleur du Pacha, the fierceness and the inordinate melancholy of Orientals was mediated not by actual fear for life or disoriented lostness, but by Volney and George Sale, whose learned work translated barbarous splendor into usable information for the sublimely talented poet. What Orientalists like Lane, Sacy, Renan, Volney, Jones, not to mention the Description de l'Égypte, and other pioneers made available, the literary crowd exploited. We must recall now our earlier discussion of the three types of work dealing with the Orient and based upon actual residence there. The rigorous exigencies of knowledge purged from Orientalist writing an authorial sensibility. Hence Lane's self-excision, and hence also the first kind of work we enumerated. As for types 2 and 3, the self is there prominently, subservient to a voice whose job it is to dispense real knowledge, type 2, or dominating and mediating everything we are told about the Orient, type 3. Yet, from one end of the 19th century to the other, after Napoleon, that is, the Orient was a place of pilgrimage, and every major work belonging to a genuine, if not always to an academic, Orientalism, took its form, style, and intention from the idea of pilgrimage there. In this idea, as in so many of the other forms of Orientalist writing we have been discussing, the romantic idea of restorative reconstruction, natural supernaturalism, is the principal source. Every pilgrim sees things his own way, but there are limits to what a pilgrimage can be for, to what shape and form it can take, to what truths it reveals. All pilgrimages to the Orient passed through, or had to pass through, the biblical lands. Most of them, in fact, were attempts either to relive or to liberate from the large, incredibly fecund Orient some portion of Judeo-Christian, Greco-Roman actuality. For these pilgrims, the Orientalized Orient, the Orient of Orientalist scholars, was a gauntlet to be run, just as the Bible, the Crusades, Islam, Napoleon, and Alexander were redoubtable predecessors to be reckoned with. Not only does a learned Orient inhibit the pilgrim's musings and private fantasies, its very antecedents places barriers between the contemporary traveler and his writing, unless, as was the case with Nerval and Flaubert in their use of Lane, Orientalist work is severed from the library and caught in the aesthetic project. Another inhibition is that Orientalist writing is too circumscribed by the official requirements of Orientalist learning. A pilgrim like Chateaubriand claimed insolently that he undertook his voyages exclusively for his own sake. J'allais chercher des images, voilà tout. Flaubert, Vigny, Nerval, Kinglake, Disraeli, Burton, all undertook their pilgrimages in order to dispel the mustiness of the pre-existing Orientalist archive. Their writing was to be a fresh new repository of Oriental experience, But, as we shall see, even this project usually, but not always, resolved itself into the reductionism of the Orientalistic. The reasons are complex, and they have very much to do with the nature of the pilgrim, his mode of writing, and the intentional form of his work. What was the Orient for the individual traveler in the 19th century? Consider first the differences between an English speaker and a French speaker. For the former, the Orient was India, of course, an actual British possession. To pass through the Near Orient was therefore to pass en route to a major colony. Already, then, the room available for imaginative play was limited by the realities of administration, territorial legality, and executive power. Scott, Kinglake, Disraeli, Warburton, Burton, and even George Eliot, in whose Daniel Deronda the Orient has plans made for it, are writers, like Lane himself and Jones before him, for whom the Orient was defined by material possession, by a material imagination, as it were. England had defeated Napoleon, evicted France. What the English mind surveyed was an imperial domain which, by the 1880s, had become an unbroken patch of British-held territory, from the Mediterranean to India. To write about Egypt, Syria, or Turkey, as much as traveling in them, was a matter of touring the realm of political will, political management, political definition. The territorial imperative was extremely compelling, even for so unrestrained a writer as Disraeli, whose Tancred is not merely an Oriental lark, but an exercise in the astute political management of actual forces on actual territories. In contrast, the French pilgrim was imbued with a sense of acute loss in the Orient. He came there to a place in which France, unlike Britain, had no sovereign presence. The Mediterranean echoed with the sounds of French defeats, from the Crusades to Napoleon. What was to become known as La Mission Civilisatrice began in the 19th century as a political second best to Britain's presence. Consequently, French pilgrims from Volney on planned and projected for, imagined, ruminated about places that were principally in their minds. They constructed schemes for a typically French, perhaps even a European concert in the Orient, which of course they supposed would be orchestrated by them. Theirs was the Orient of memories, suggestive ruins, forgotten secrets, hidden correspondences, and an almost virtuosic style of being, an Orient whose highest literary forms would be found in Nerval and Flaubert, both of whose work was solidly fixed in an imaginative, unrealizable, except aesthetically, dimension. This was also true to a certain extent of scholarly French travelers in the Orient. Most of them were interested in the biblical past or in the Crusades, as Henri Bordeaux has argued in his Voyageurs d'Orient. To these names we must add, at Hassan Annouti's suggestion, the names of Oriental Semiticists, including Quatremer, Solsi, the explorer of the Dead Sea, Renan as Phoenician archaeologist, Judas, the student of Phoenician languages, Catafago and de Frémery, who studied the Ansarians, Ismailis, and Seljuks, Clermont Ganot, who explored Judea, and the Marquis de Vauguet, whose work centered on Palmyrian epigraphy. In addition, there was the whole school of Egyptologists descended from Champollion and Mariette, a school that would later include Maspero and Legrain. As an index of the difference between British realities and French fantasies, it is worthwhile recalling the words in Cairo of the painter Ludovic Lepic, who commented sadly in 1884, 2 years after the British occupation had begun, "L'Orient est mort au Caire." Only Renan, ever the realistic racist, condoned the British suppression of Arabi's nationalist rebellion, which, out of his greater wisdom, he said was a disgrace to civilization. Unlike Volney and Napoleon, the 19th century French pilgrims did not seek a scientific, so much as an exotic yet especially attractive reality. This is obviously true of the literary pilgrims, beginning with Chateaubriand, who found in the Orient a locale sympathetic to their private myths, obsessions, and requirements. Here, we notice how all the pilgrims, but especially the French ones, exploit the Orient in their work so as, in some urgent way, to justify their existential vocation. Only when there is some additional cognitive purpose in writing about the Orient does the outpouring of self seem more under control. Lamartine, for instance, writes about himself and also about France as a power in the Orient. That second enterprise mutes and finally controls imperatives heaped upon his style by his soul, his memory, and his imagination. No pilgrim, French or English, could so ruthlessly dominate his self or his subject as Lane did. Even Burton and T.E. Lawrence, of whom the former fashioned a deliberately Muslim pilgrimage and the latter what he called a reverse pilgrimage away from Mecca, delivered masses of historical, political, and social Orientalism that were never as free of their egos as Lane's were of his. This is why Burton, Lawrence, and Charles Doughty occupy a middle position between Lane and Chateaubriand. Chateaubriand's Itinéraire de Paris à Jérusalem et de Jérusalem à Paris, 1810 to 1811, records the details of a journey undertaken in 1805 to 1806, after he had traveled in North America. Its many hundreds of pages bear witness to its author's admission that Je parle éternellement de moi, so much so that Stendhal, no self-abnegating writer himself, could find Chateaubriand's failure as a knowledgeable traveler to be the result of his stinking egotism. He brought a very heavy load of personal objectives and suppositions to the Orient, unloaded them there, and proceeded thereafter to push people, places, and ideas around in the Orient as if nothing could resist his imperious imagination. Chateaubriand came to the Orient as a constructed figure, not as a true self. For him, Bonaparte was the last crusader. He, in turn, was the last Frenchman who left his country to travel in the Holy Land with the ideas, the goals, and the sentiments of a pilgrim of former times. But there were other reasons. Symmetry. Having been to the New World and seen its monuments of nature, he needed to complete his circle of studies by visiting the Orient and its monuments of knowledge. As he had studied Roman and Celtic antiquity, all that was left for him was the ruins of Athens, Memphis, and Carthage. Self-completion. He needed to replenish his stock of images. Confirmation of the importance of the religious spirit. Religion is a kind of universal language understood by all men. And where better to observe it than there in the Orient, even in lands where a comparatively low religion like Islam held sway? Above all, the need to see things, not as they were, but as Chateaubriand supposed they were. The Quran was Le Livre de Mahomet. It contained ni principe de civilisation, ni précepte qui puisse élever le caractère. This book, he continued, more or less freely inventing as he went along, preaches neither hatred of tyranny nor love of liberty. To so preciously constituted a figure as Chateaubriand, the Orient was a decrepit canvas awaiting his restorative efforts. The Oriental Arab was civilized man fallen again into a savage state. No wonder, then, that as he watched Arabs trying to speak French, Chateaubriand felt like Robinson Crusoe, thrilled by hearing his parrot speak for the first time. True, there were places like Bethlehem, whose etymological meaning Chateaubriand got completely wrong, in which one found again some semblance of real, that is, European civilization, but those were few and far between. Everywhere, one encountered Orientals, Arabs, whose civilization, religion, and manners were so low, barbaric and antithetical as to merit reconquest. The Crusades, he argued, were not aggression. They were a just Christian counterpart to Omar's arrival in Europe. Besides, he added, even if the Crusades in their modern or original form were aggression, the issue they raised transcended such questions of ordinary mortality. The Crusades were not only about the deliverance of the Holy Sepulchre, but more about knowing which would win on the earth, a cult that was civilization's enemy, systematically favorable to ignorance, this was Islam, of course, to despotism, to slavery, or a cult that had caused to reawaken in modern people the genius of a sage antiquity and had abolished base servitude. This is the first significant mention of an idea that will acquire an almost unbearable, next to mindless authority in European writing, the theme of Europe teaching the Orient the meaning of liberty, which is an idea that Chateaubriand and everyone after him believed that Orientals, and especially Muslims, knew nothing about. Of liberty they know nothing, of propriety they have none. Force is their god. When they go for long periods without seeing conquerors who do heavenly justice, they have the air of soldiers without a leader, citizens without legislators, and a family without a father. Already in 1810, we have a European talking like Cromer in 1910, arguing that Orientals require conquest, and finding it no paradox that a Western conquest of the Orient was not conquest after all, but liberty. Chateaubriand puts the whole idea in the romantic, redemptive terms of a Christian mission to revive a dead world, to quicken in it a sense of its own potential, one which only a European can discern underneath a lifeless and degenerate surface. For the traveler, this means that he must use the Old Testament and the Gospels as his guide in Palestine. Only in this way can the apparent degeneration of the modern Orient be gotten beyond. Yet Chateaubriand senses no irony in the fact that his tour and his vision will reveal nothing to him about the modern Oriental and his destiny. What matters about the Orient is what it lets happen to Chateaubriand, what it allows his spirit to do, what it permits him to reveal about himself, his ideas, his expectations. The liberty that so concerns him is no more than his own release from the Orient's hostile wastes. Where his release allows him to go is directly back into the realm of imagination and imaginative interpretation. Description of the Orient is obliterated by the designs and patterns foisted upon it by the imperial ego, which makes no secret of its powers. If in Lane's prose we watch the ego disappear so that the Orient may appear in all its realistic detail, in Chateaubriand, the ego dissolves itself in the contemplation of wonders it creates, and then is reborn, stronger than ever, more able to savor its powers and enjoy its interpretations. When one travels in Judea, at first a great ennui grips the heart. But when, passing from one solitary place to another, space stretches out without limits before you, slowly the ennui dissipates, and one feels a secret terror, which, far from depressing the soul, gives it courage and elevates one's native genius. Extraordinary things are disclosed from all parts of an earth worked over by miracles. The burning sun, the impetuous eagle, the sterile fig tree, all of poetry, all the scenes from scripture are present there. Every name encloses a mystery, every grotto declares the future, every summit retains within it the accents of a prophet. God himself has spoken from these shores. The arid torrents, the riven rocks, the open tombs attest to the prodigy. The desert still seems struck dumb with terror, and one would say that it has still not been able to break the silence since it heard the voice of the Eternal. The process of thought in this passage is revealing. An experience of Pascalian terror does not merely reduce one's self-confidence, it miraculously stimulates it. The barren landscape stands forth like an illuminated text presenting itself to the scrutiny of a very strong, refortified ego. Chateaubriand has transcended the abject, if frightening, reality of the contemporary Orient so that he may stand in an original and creative relationship to it. By the end of the passage, he is no longer a modern man, but a visionary seer, more or less contemporary with God. If the Judean desert has been silent since God spoke there, it is Chateaubriand who can hear the silence, understand its meaning, and, to his reader, make the desert speak again. The great gifts of sympathetic intuition which had enabled Chateaubriand to represent and interpret North American mysteries in René and Atala, as well as Christianity in Le Génie du Christianisme, are aroused to even greater feats of interpretation during the Itinéraire. No longer is the author dealing with natural primitivity and romantic sentiment. Here, he is dealing with eternal creativity and divine originality themselves, for it is in the biblical Orient that they were first deposited, and they have remained there in unmediated and latent form. Of course, they cannot be simply grasped. They must be aspired to and achieved by Chateaubriand. And it is this ambitious purpose that the Itinéraire is made to serve, just as in the text, Chateaubriand's ego must be reconstructed radically enough to get the job done. Unlike Lane, Chateaubriand attempts to consume the Orient. He not only appropriates it, he represents and speaks for it, not in history, but beyond history, in the timeless dimension of a completely healed world, where men and lands, God and men, are as one. In Jerusalem, therefore, at the center of his vision and at the ultimate end of his pilgrimage, he grants himself a sort of total reconciliation with the Orient as Jewish, Christian, Muslim, Greek, Persian, Roman, and finally French. He is moved by the plight of the Jews, but he judges that they too serve to illuminate his general vision, and as a further benefit, they give the necessary poignance to his Christian vindictiveness. God, he says, has chosen a new people, and it is not the Jews. He makes some other concessions to terrestrial reality, however. If Jerusalem is booked into his itinerary as its final extraterrestrial goal, Egypt provides him with material for a political excursus. His ideas about Egypt supplement his pilgrimage nicely. The magnificent Nile Delta moves him to assert that I found only the memories of my glorious country worthy of those magnificent plains. I saw the remains of monuments of a new civilization brought to the banks of the Nile by the genius of France. But these ideas are put in a nostalgic mode because in Egypt, Chateaubriand believes he can equate the absence of France with the absence of a free government ruling a happy people. Besides, after Jerusalem, Egypt appears to be only a kind of spiritual anticlimax. After political commentary on its sorry state, Chateaubriand asks himself the routine question about difference as a result of historical development. How can this degenerate, stupid mob of Musulmans have come to inhabit the same land whose vastly different owners so impressed Herodotus and Diodorus? This is a fitting valedictory to Egypt, which he leaves for Tunis, Carthaginian ruins, and finally home. Yet he does one last thing of note in Egypt. Unable to do more than look at the pyramids from a distance, he takes the trouble to send an emissary there, to have him inscribe his, Chateaubriand's, name on the stone, adding for our benefit, one has to fulfill all the little obligations of a pious traveler. We would not ordinarily give much more than amused attention to this charming bit of touristic banality. As a preparation, however, for the very last page of the Itinéraire, it appears more important than at first glance. reflecting on his 20-year project to study Tous les hasards et tous les chagrins as an exile, Chateaubriand notes elegiacally how every one of his books has been, in fact, a kind of prolongation of his existence. A man with neither a home nor the possibility of acquiring one, he finds himself now well past his youth. If heaven accords him eternal rest, he says, he promises to dedicate himself in silence to erecting a monument à ma patrie. What he is left with on earth, however, is his writing, which, if his name will live, has been enough, and if it will not live, has been too much. These closing lines send us back to Chateaubriand's interest in getting his name inscribed on the pyramids. We will have understood that his egoistic Oriental memoirs supply us with a constantly demonstrated and indefatigably performed experience of self. Writing was an act of life for Chateaubriand, for whom nothing, not even a distant piece of stone, must remain scriptively untouched by him if he was to stay alive. If the order of Lane's narrative was to be violated by scientific authority and enormous detail, then Chateaubriand's was to be transformed into the asserted will of an egoistic, highly volatile individual. Whereas Lane would sacrifice his ego to the Orientalist canon, Chateaubriand would make everything he said about the Orient wholly dependent on his ego. Yet neither writer could conceive of his posterity as continuing on fruitfully after him. Lane entered the impersonality of a technical discipline. His work would be used, but not as a human document. Chateaubriand, on the other hand, saw that his writing, like the token inscription of his name on a pyramid, would signify his self. If not, if he had not succeeded in prolonging his life by writing, it would be merely excessive, superfluous. Even if all travelers to the Orient after Chateaubriand and Lane have taken their work into account, in some cases even to the extent of copying from them verbatim, their legacy embodies the fate of Orientalism and the options to which it was limited. Either one wrote science like Lane, or personal utterance like Chateaubriand. The problems with the former were its impersonal Western confidence that descriptions of general, collective phenomena were possible, and its tendency to make realities not so much out of the Orient as out of its own observations. The problem with personal utterance was that it inevitably retreated into a position equating the Orient with private fantasy, even if that fantasy was of a very high order indeed, aesthetically speaking. In both cases, of course, Orientalism enjoyed a powerful influence on how the Orient was described and characterized. But what that influence always prevented, even until today, was some sense of the Orient that was neither impossibly general nor imperturbably private. To look into Orientalism for a lively sense of an Oriental's human or even social reality as a contemporary inhabitant of the modern world is to look in vain. The influence of the two options I have described, Lane's and Chateaubriand's, British and French, is a great deal of the reason for this omission. The growth of knowledge, particularly specialized knowledge, is a very slow process. Far from being merely additive or cumulative, the growth of knowledge is a process of selective accumulation, displacement, deletion, rearrangement, and insistence within what has been called a research consensus. The legitimacy of such knowledge as Orientalism was during the 19th century stemmed not from religious authority, as had been the case before the Enlightenment, but from what we can call the restorative citation of antecedent authority. Beginning with Sacy, the learned Orientalist's attitude was that of a scientist who surveyed a series of textual fragments, which he thereafter edited and arranged as a restorer of old sketches might put a series of them together for the cumulative picture they implicitly represent. Consequently, Amongst themselves, Orientalists treat each other's work in the same citationary way. Burton, for example, would deal with the Arabian Nights or with Egypt indirectly through Lane's work by citing his predecessor, challenging him even though he was granting him very great authority. Nerval's own voyage to the Orient was by way of Lamartine's, and the latter's by way of Chateaubriand. In short, as a form of growing knowledge, Orientalism resorted mainly to citations of predecessor scholars in the field for its nutriment. Even when new materials came his way, the Orientalist judged them by borrowing from predecessors, as scholars so often do, their perspectives, ideologies, and guiding theses. In a fairly strict way, then, Orientalists after Sacy and Lane rewrote Sacy and Lane. After Chateaubriand, pilgrims rewrote him. From these complex rewritings, the actualities of the modern Orient were systematically excluded, especially when gifted pilgrims like Nerval and Flaubert preferred Lane's descriptions to what their eyes and minds showed them immediately. In the system of knowledge about the Orient is less a place than a topos, a set of references, a congeries of characteristics that seems to have its origin in a quotation, or a fragment of a text, or a citation from someone's work on the Orient, or some bit of previous imagining, or an amalgam of all these. Direct observation or circumstantial description of the Orient are the fictions presented by writing on the Orient, yet invariably these are totally secondary to systematic tasks of another sort. In Lamartine, Nerval, and Flaubert, the Orient is a representation of canonical material guided by an aesthetic and executive will capable of producing interest in the reader. Yet in all three writers, Orientalism or some aspect of it is asserted, even though, as I said earlier, the narrative consciousness is given a very large role to play. What we shall see is that for all its eccentric individuality, this narrative consciousness will end up by being aware, like Bouvard and Pécuchet, that pilgrimage is, after all, a form of copying. When he began his trip to the Orient in 1833, Lamartine did so, he said, as something he had always dreamed about. Un voyage en Orient était comme un grand acte de ma vie intérieure. He is a bundle of predispositions, sympathies, biases. He hates the Romans and Carthage, and loves Jews, Egyptians, and Hindus, whose Dante he claims he will become. Armed with a formal verse adieu to France, in which he lists everything that he plans to do in the Orient, he embarks for the East. At first, everything he encounters either confirms his poetic predictions or realizes his propensity for analogy. Lady Hester Stanhope is the Circe of the desert. The Orient is the patrie de mon imagination. The Arabs are a primitive people. Biblical poetry is engraved on the land of Lebanon. The Orient testifies to the attractive largeness of Asia and to Greece's comparative smallness. Soon after he reaches Palestine, however, he becomes the incorrigible maker of an imaginary Orient. He alleges that the plains of Canaan appear to best advantage in the works of Poussin and Lorrain. From being a translation, as he called it earlier, his voyage is now turned into a prayer, which exercises his memory, soul, and heart more than it does his eyes, mind, or spirit. This candid announcement completely unlooses Lamartine's analogic and reconstructive and undisciplined zeal. Christianity is a religion of imagination and recollection, and since Lamartine considers that he typifies the pious believer, he indulges himself accordingly. A catalogue of his tendentious observations would be interminable. A woman he sees reminds him of Aidee in Don Juan. The relationship between Jesus and Palestine is like that between Rousseau and Geneva. The actual River Jordan is less important than the mysteries it gives rise to in one's soul. Orientals, and Muslims in particular, are lazy. Their politics are capricious, passionate, and futureless. Another woman reminds him of a passage in Attala. Neither Tasso nor Chateaubriand, whose antecedent travels seem often to harass Lamartine's otherwise heedless egoism, got the Holy Land right. And on and on. His pages on Arabic poetry, about which he discourses with supreme confidence, betray no discomfort at his total ignorance of the language. All that matters to him is that his travels in the Orient reveal to him how the Orient is la terre des cultes, des prodiges, and that he is its appointed poet in the West. With no trace of self-irony, he announces, "This Arab land is the land of prodigies. Everything sprouts there, and every credulous or fanatical man can become a prophet there in his turn." He has become a prophet merely by the fact of residence in the Orient. By the end of his narrative, Lamartine has achieved the purpose of his pilgrimage to the Holy Sepulchre, that beginning and endpoint of all time and space. He has internalized reality enough to want to retreat from it back into pure contemplation, solitude, philosophy, and poetry. Rising above the merely geographical Orient, he is transformed into a latter-day Chateaubriand, surveying the East as if it were a personal, or at the very least a French, province ready to be disposed of by European powers. From being a traveler and pilgrim in real time and space, Lamartine has become a transpersonal ego, identifying itself in power and consciousness with the whole of Europe. What he sees before him is the Orient in the process of its inevitable future dismemberment, being taken over and consecrated by European suzerainty. Thus, in Lamartine's climactic vision, the Orient is reborn as European right to power over it. This sort of suzerainty thus defined and consecrated as a European right will consist principally in the right to occupy one or another territory, as well as the coasts, in order to found there either free cities or European colonies or commercial ports of call. Nor does Lamartine stop at this. He climbs still higher to the point where the Orient, what he has just seen and where he has just been, is reduced to nations without territory, patrie, rights, laws, or security, waiting anxiously for the shelter of European occupation. In all the visions of the Orient fabricated by Orientalism, there is no recapitulation, literally, as entire as this one. For Lamartine, a pilgrimage to the Orient has involved not only the penetration of the Orient by an imperious consciousness, but also the virtual elimination of that consciousness as a result of its accession to a kind of impersonal and continental control over the Orient. The Orient's actual identity is withered away into a set of consecutive fragments. Lamartine's recollective observations, which are later to be gathered up and brought forth as a restated Napoleonic dream of world hegemony. Whereas Lane's human identity disappeared into the scientific grid of his Egyptian classifications, Lamartine's consciousness transgresses its normal bounds completely. In so doing, it repeats Chateaubriand's journey and his visions only to move on beyond them, into the sphere of the Shelleyan and Napoleonic abstract, by which worlds and populations are moved about like so many cards on a table. What remains of the Orient in Lamartine's prose is not very substantial at all. Its geopolitical reality has been overlaid with his plans for it. The sites he has visited, the people he has met, the experiences he has had, are reduced to a few echoes in his pompous generalizations. The last traces of particularity have been rubbed out in the résumé politique with which the Voyage en Orient concludes. Against the transcendent quasi-national egoism of Lamartine, we must place Nerval and Flaubert in contrast. Their Oriental works play a substantial role in their total oeuvre, a much greater one than Lamartine's imperialist Voyage in his oeuvre.